DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW, your one-stop shop for all the latest in science and technology. I'm Zulfikar Abani, and coming up, video games go serious to bridge the gap between the market and innovation.
I think this game is an essential link between the micro-behavior of individual entrepreneurs and how the market eventually looks like. At the moment, we don't understand this link, and this game is really a useful tool to help us there.
Also on the program, mapping the DNA of a banana and the elusive but pioneering eye doctor from Italy. All that and more right here on Spectrum. But first, it was a conference that straddled both enthusiastic optimism and sobering reality. 34 million people worldwide are infected with HIV, the virus that can lead to AIDS. There's neither a cure nor a vaccine. But the organisers of the 19th International AIDS Conference in Washington, D.C. hoped to turn the tide together, as their motto suggested. The idea was to declare that now is the beginning of the end of AIDS. DW Washington correspondent Christina Bergmann was there and filed this report.
The means to fight AIDS are well known. Doctors have almost 30 antiretroviral drugs to choose from to provide care to HIV-infected patients. If the patients start treatment early and stay on their medicine, their life expectancy is only slightly lower than that of a non-infected person. 56% of infected people worldwide are now being treated. But it was keynote speaker Bill Clinton who, on the last day of the conference, pointed out that there are still huge regional differences.
But look at the numbers in the area where there's more stigma. In Central and Eastern Europe, way less than that. In the Middle East and North Africa, even less than that. Not even 25% in the latter, barely a third in the former. So we, all of us, can't be blind to the fact that no matter how much we come together and cheer each other and see the evidence, that we still have to fight stigma wherever we find it.
Germany is a role model in this regard, says Holger Wicht, spokesperson for the German AIDS Service Organization, because its prevention strategy is based on human rights.
The government knows it's very important to work hand in hand with all the most affected groups, like gays, drug users, sex workers, and so on. Repression, exclusion, discrimination are big obstacles to HIV prevention. It's not possible to help people to protect themselves by repression.
In his speech, the former US president also focused on another problem, money. Clinton's foundation has been collecting funds for AIDS relief for a decade. But this year, for example, the Global Fund, which helps finance the fight against AIDS, malaria and tuberculosis, had to cancel all its grant programs. For the first time, the majority of the money isn't coming from international coffers, but from the affected nations themselves. Oliver Moldenhauer from Doctors Without Borders considers the conference a success and an inspiration for the participants, but he too points to the financial problems and has experienced an unwillingness of donors to provide money recently. He says the investment practices of the US and Germany, for example, differ substantially. The US provides a lot of help for countries in Africa, but not at home.
But it leads to a strange situation that everybody in Swaziland who needs AIDS drugs gets them paid for immediately by the US government. Say a black gay man poor in Washington doesn't get them as easily as someone in Swaziland that's from the US government.
In Germany, it's the other way around, he said. The Germans take good care of infected people within their own country, but Germany is
pretty bleak when it comes to international engagement. I mean, the Netherlands, which are much, much smaller than Germany, the Netherlands invest more into the international fight against HIV/AIDS than the German government.
Moldenhauer explains why more money is urgently needed worldwide.
With the growth of resistances, we need newer AIDS drugs for more and more people. And they are patented. They are more expensive. That problem needs to be overcome to be successful.
Doctors Without Borders is calling for pharmaceutical companies to allow drugs to be produced generically, as well as for the removal of international patent protection in countries where these companies are uncooperative. The global goal agreed upon the conference is ambitious. By 2015, the number of new infections should be halved, each patient should have access to treatment, and mother-to-child transmission will be unheard of. Theoretically, it is possible. The steps needed are known. Treatment as prevention is one of them. Dr. Anthony Harries from the International Union Against Tuberculosis and Lung Disease in Paris said,
if we can use antiretroviral treatment earlier for treatment and prevention, we can do a lot to try and turn around this epidemic.
Beginning treatment early is also a way, he said, to reduce secondary diseases as a result of AIDS, like tuberculosis, a common cause of death in sub-Saharan Africa. But then again, scientific progress alone does not lead to a successful fight against HIV and AIDS, said Jürgen Pillay, deputy director of the South African Department of Health.
My major concern when I go back home is, so what do I do with all of these things? You know, how do I implement them? Because if you don't implement them, they're not as useful as we would like to think of them.
So despite the progress in the fight against HIV and AIDS, the challenges remain. Christina Bergmann, DW, Washington.
Well, while some see reason for hope, others say it may indeed be too early to suggest the tide is turning. A new study into the efficacy of AIDS drugs in Africa has found resistance rates are rising, especially in eastern Africa. Dr. Ravindra Gupta, a Wellcome Trust Clinical Research Fellow at University College London, is a co-author of the report, and he told me that the surveillance of drug resistance rates urgently needs to be integrated into treatment programs if we're to save decades of progress.
The hard facts of the study are that since retrovirals were rolled out in sub-Saharan Africa, there has been an increase in drug resistance seen in untreated patients. And the greatest increases have been happening in eastern Africa and, to a lesser extent, southern Africa.
And to and a significant West, extent, yes. Right? Over the last 8 years is what we're talking about.
Yes. Yeah, so rollout happened in different years in different countries. So that's why we haven't really been able to attach very hard dates. So, for example, on average in East Africa, rollout happened quite early, so it's between 2000 and 2003, whereas in Southern Africa, it's more like 2003, 2004. So really, you know, through the last decade or so, drug resistance rates have been increasing, and in particular to one class of antiretrovirals, which is the non-nucleoside drugs. And these are really the cornerstone of any therapy, so these are sort of the most important drug classes.
And as I understand it, these are also drugs that are used in the prevention of transmission of the virus from a pregnant woman to an unborn child. And that would probably present a very serious threat to the UN's goals of reducing the number of babies born with HIV, wouldn't it?
Potentially. Yes, nevirapine is a drug that's used for preventing vertical transmission. And it's resistance to that class that we're concerned about. And the sort of levels we've seen are around 5% to the non-nucleoside. So it's 5% to that class of drugs. What WHO are moving towards is to actually get mothers onto antiretroviral therapy during their pregnancy. So to give them three drugs instead of just a single drug. And that decision may be influenced by the amount of resistance because, of course, non-nucleosides are part of those regimens. So we're probably going to be using a class of drugs called protease inhibitors in pregnant women in the future. So the development goals, the UN goals, could still be achieved if we just take this into account.
And can you explain the significance of what you've seen here, that these rates have actually remained stable, though, throughout this period?
Well, what we've done is we've done an analysis over time. We have data from each year since the rollout happened. So what we've been able to do is model this over time. And certainly the East Africa data suggests that the rates are increasing over time. And the increases are much more gentle for Southern Africa and West Africa.
So what does need to be done now? I mean, what are the immediate implications for the science behind the research into HIV/AIDS drugs?
We actually have a good array of drugs that are available. So the question in the developing world is, what do we do next? And so in the developing world, there are only two lines of treatment, first and second line. So the range of drugs that are available is much more limited, and that's why there's a problem. You know, we have higher rates of drug resistance in this country in untreated patients, but the fact is that we do baseline resistance testing, and we have a much wider range of drugs to choose from, so we can tailor therapy for people. But in the resource-poor world, that doesn't happen. Everybody gets the same combinations of drugs. And so that's the real research agenda issue for the developing world, is to decide how to screen patients for drug resistance at baseline.
But you have said that if these rates do continue to rise, then that would jeopardise all the work that's been put in so far into decreasing...
It could jeopardise some of the gains made so far if they just continue to increase and we didn't do anything about it. So that's certainly true. What this data does call for is increased surveillance in sub-Saharan Africa in particular. So we need to be collecting resistance data. So we want strengthening, what we're calling for is strengthening of systems to ensure that surveillance is a priority for these programs of retroviral delivery so that we can really keep an eye on this problem. And at the moment, you know, surveillance is not the top priority of many treatment programs. You know, the pressure's off just to get people on medication. Well, what we're saying is that we need to really make drug-resistant surveillance integral to this effort.
Dr. Ravindra Gupta of University College London speaking to me there on a slightly shaky mobile line. Apologies for that. You're listening to Spectrum, however, with me, Zulfikar Abani, on DW. And hey, I wonder whether you heard about this. If you're at the London Olympics, it's possible that you haven't actually heard about this because apparently London's data networks can't cope at the moment. People at the Games are being asked to avoid all non-essential text messages and tweets, whatever non-essential means, because the local data networks are overloaded and it's affecting TV coverage the sporting event. On these eggshells we tread, hey? Well, we love a good tweet, so get on DW_SciTech or check out our wares at dw.de/science.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
Serious games, that's video games designed as learning tools, are still in the experimental phase, but the Utrecht University has decided to become the first in the Netherlands to invest seriously in serious games, and one in particular called Solar Tycoon. It was introduced to bachelor students earlier this year, and the game is now being promoted at the Utrecht Summer School. It's used as an important tool for doctoral research work as well. Laura Posma reports from Utrecht.
Video games and science do not sound like an obvious combination. But for Frank van Rijnsoever, assistant professor in innovation studies, the game Solar Tycoon is an important part of his research. In the game, one or more individuals have to set up a business and sell solar panels. The contestant needs to compete with other entrepreneurs and pay attention to a changing environment and fluctuating prices.
My research is about how entrepreneurs and scientists together develop new innovations. So we want to know how we can stimulate entrepreneurs to produce new innovations. And if you have a game setting, then you have a controlled environment and you can see exactly when they are most likely to collaborate or to produce innovations.
For Van Rijnsoever, the game is a unique way to gather new data. He is the first person to use a serious game in his doctoral research. He says his project would be impossible without it.
I think this game is an essential link between the microbehavior of individual entrepreneurs and how the market eventually looks like. At the moment, we don't understand this link. And this game is really a useful tool to help us there. I am hoping to find out that we can actually predict how the current market looks like and that we can understand what behavioral patterns underlie this outcome. We can say what the right conditions are, for example, to nurture a market for sustainable innovations.
At the Utrecht Summer School, international students of the course Innovations for a Sustainable Future are playing the game Solar Tycoon. The students have different educational backgrounds, and it's hoped the game will teach them how innovation works in practice. Simona Negro coordinates the course.
Most of them did environmental science, environmental studies, engineering studies, so they've been taught a more like natural science background. But during the summer school, we teach them also about innovation theories and sustainability theories. But with the game, I guess it really brings the theory much more alive and will also help them maybe if one day they want to set up a company.
Summer school student Pradyum Raju from New Delhi, India, is excited about Solar Tycoon and says he has learned a lot.
Before playing this game, I didn't really have an idea how the solar panels market works. But now I have a practical knowledge about the different types of solar panels which are being used in the real world. And I have an idea how much the solar energy can be utilized for electricity. I come from an engineering background, so I may not be directly linked to the renewable energy field, but I can pretty much work in the technical aspects of the renewable energy. So yeah, it was quite important for me. Yeah. And this course as well, it teaches me a lot, which I can apply back home.
Course coordinator Simona Negro says serious games like Solar Tycoon could provide an alternative to internships at a time when there are limited placements for students in the geosciences.
We have like 60, 70 bachelor students and 30 master students every year. So, yeah, there's not unlimited place in companies to place them. So, indeed, a game like that would be really a nice alternative. And I guess there could be even a more real-life dimension if we could also commit some companies to also play in the game.
But Assistant Professor Frank van Rijnsoever does not fully agree. He says serious games are no substitute for on-the-job experience.
An internship can be beat, but it can be a very good preparation to an internship. You know, the students know that there are limitations, but still they are placed in an environment where they experience being an entrepreneur. And that's really important because most of the teaching nowadays is focuses either at studying cases, perhaps doing interviews at companies, but it's very rarely incorporates putting the student into an entrepreneurial environment. That's what we really try to simulate.
It is this that van Rijnsoever would like to build on. He would like to see Solar Tycoon simulate working environments for scientists as well as entrepreneurs.
The most important goal to use it in the end for scientists is to predict under what conditions these scientists are most likely to collaborate with entrepreneurs. But for scientists, it's more rewarding to collaborate with other scientists to produce scientific papers, to receive citations, than to collaborate with entrepreneurs. We try to find conditions under which scientists are more inclined to share their knowledge with these entrepreneurs, and also find conditions under which entrepreneurs are most inclined to collaborate with science.
For Frank van Rijnsoever, Solar Tycoon is a new addition to his research of predicting the behavior of entrepreneurs and scientists. For Utrecht University, the game is a way of showing that the university can play a leading role in developing innovative learning tools. It is likely that other universities will soon follow. This is Laura Postma for DW in Utrecht.
Now, of course, a lot of us forget to eat sometimes when we're on the video games. Some pop stars even get all depressed when their boyfriends are on the Xbox. Hey, Lana. But wait, stop. I've got a remedy. You should always have a banana at the ready. They're delicious and fascinating as well because, listen up, French researchers have just sequenced the DNA of a banana and say that it could help allay food security fears. Led by Angélique Dante of CIRAD, the researchers say that their work is an important step towards understanding the genetics of the crop and strengthening varieties against fungus and pests. But Angélique Dant told me CIRAD wants to avoid genetically modifying bananas.
85% of banana production is consumed locally in a tropical and subtropical country. So it provides a staple food and a major source of income for over 500 million of people. And half of the production is due to only one cultivar or one group of cultivar derived from only one seed. And this group of cultivar is now pests and disease have gradually become adapted to this cultivar.
So we're talking about monocultures. The pests have become resistant within these monocultures.
Exactly, yes.
So how can your findings help farmers, cultivators, beat the pest?
Because of this situation, it's important to breed new resistant variety cultivar. But breeding in banana, it's quite complicated, partly because a banana has to produce sterile fruit. That means fruit without seeds to be eatable. And for making new banana, you have to perform cross, so you need to have a fertile plant. So we have sequenced one banana genotype, and we have identified 36,000 genes, and we know the exact position of this gene on the chromosome. So now the next challenge is to find among those genes which ones are important for conferring resistance to the main disease and also for conferring good fruit quality.
And which are the main diseases, or which is the main disease?
There is two main diseases at the moment, the Panama disease and the Black Sigatoga disease.
And whereabouts do these diseases affect crops most, in which countries?
The Black Sigatoga is now in all the world, and the Panama disease, a new race of Panama disease is now in Asia only, but will probably extend to other areas.
Of course, the idea, as you've been explaining, is to, in effect, you'll want to genetically modify.
No. In fact, the first step is to identify the gene that's important for resistance. And then this information can be used, indeed, to modify it by transgenesis, to modify the current cultivar. But another approach, which is the one we are pursuing in CIRAD, is to to breed a new cultivar by crossing different cultivar having different type of resistance, by breeding, I mean. And so, and knowing which gene and which genotype have the important gene will help a lot the breeder to create new cultivar by a classical breeding.
So you're avoiding genetic modification then?
There is two strategies, classical breeding or genetic transformation. At CIRAD, at the moment, we have chosen to work with the breeding strategy, but other groups are working with the other strategy, and the availability of the sequence will help both strategy anyway.
What sort of a response do you expect to find from cultivators and also indeed from national governments? Do you expect them to take this up? Because, I mean, as we've been discussing, bananas are a staple food. Do you expect governments to readily and farmers to readily adopt what you come up with?
I think if there is a banana which has good quality and a resistance, I think they could be adapted. Because, for example, the cost of putting pesticide is important, so it represents an important cost for agriculture. But the main, I think, difficulty will be for export banana, because all the process of transporting and conserving the banana is calibrated for only one cultivar. Part of the banana production, about 15%, which are export toward industrialized country, they are transport in boats, in refrigerated condition. And all the process that has been set up to transport and conserve those banana, and all has been adapted to only one cultivar, which is the Cavendish group of cultivar. And so the industry will have to adapt their process, and it will represent also a cost, and so they will maybe not be ready to do that direct if the adaptation is too big.
So essentially, this all comes down to money, doesn't it?
Yes.
Angélique Dante, the French research body, CIRAD, speaking to me there from Montpellier. Now, from bananas to eyeballs, you may know that keratoconus is a change in the curve of the cornea that can cause visual problems, even blindness. A special treatment called corneal collagen cross-linking uses vitamin B2 combined with UVA rays, but the process also involves removing the epithelium, the cornea's top layer. For years, eye surgeons have been trying to find a non-invasive method for the vitamin B2 drops to permeate the epithelium without having to remove it. Several have done it using a technique called trans-epithelial cross-linking, but it tends to be slow and not always so successful. But now an Italian doctor says he's come up with a super-permeating solution of vitamin B2 drops that work in just a few minutes. Dr. Roberto Pignelli's accelerated trans-epithelial cross-linking procedure sounded like such a great story for Spectrum that we sent out our reporter Danny Mitz when she was as keen as ever to cover it, but all we got was this postcard from a train station in northern Italy.
What caught my attention was the newspaper headline, Vitamin B2 Eye Drops to Save the Cornea. My earliest recollection of vitamin B2, or riboflavin, was in the ingredients listed on the back of a box of cornflakes, so the idea that the same substance could be used to prevent blindness excited me. Not only that, the formula for these sight-saving drops had been invented by an Italian eye surgeon, right here in northern Italy. I had to meet this man and find out more. It took me no time to find Dr. Roberto Pignelli on the internet. There he was, pictured on the website of the institute he founded in Brescia, looking suave and commanding, like a character off the opening credits of ER or Grey's Anatomy. I emailed the clinic and got an almost immediate response. Yes, the doctor's osmotic riboflavin formula was indeed revolutionary, and I could contact him directly. I was impressed at the speed of his reply to my email. It would be a pleasure to do the interview, he wrote. Could he by any chance see me next Tuesday? I will make time after surgery, came his response. We set the date. I bought my train ticket. Tuesday, on the platform a few minutes before the train was due, I checked my mail. There was a message from Pignelli. Danny, emergency today. I can't. Hope you're not on the train. Can we do next week? I groaned. He was a doctor. It was an emergency. At least I wasn't already on board. Later, the clinic called to reschedule. Emergencies rarely happen, they assured me.
I bought a ticket for the following Monday. This time the cancellation arrived a full 2 hours before the train departure time. I was fuming, made worse by an hour in the stifling summer heat queuing to change my train ticket. Two emergencies in a row? Could the doctor really not find a half an hour for me? I began to have paranoid thoughts. Maybe his emergency was a pretty blonde lunch date. But no, this was ophthalmology's answer to Dr. Gregory House of the US TV drama, and I was just exceptionally unlucky. Still, feeling slightly peeved and having an unexpected free afternoon, I decided to do some further research. I came across several articles detailing keratoconus treatments devised by a Californian doctor called Brian Boxer-Wachler. I emailed and received a prompt response telling me that he had pioneered cross-linking with riboflavin way back in 2003 and that Pinelli had visited his LA clinic to learn how to do it. I was confused. Had my man actually invented anything? Since Pinelli had published the fruits of his experiments in the current Eye Research Journal earlier this year, I contacted one of his internationally respected co-authors, Professor Eberhard Sperl of Dresden University. He confirmed that thanks to sheer dogged tenacity, Roberto Pinelli had indeed found the key to formulating a highly absorbent riboflavin solution, making him a true innovator. "He is the father of transepithelial cross-linking," he wrote. That convinced me that I too should be tenacious with this story. I decided to try to call my elusive eye specialist, just to make sure he really was worth the effort. "Phone me at 10:30, I'll be between procedures," he wrote. I was put straight through to an exuberant voice with a rich Italian accent. He was excited about his invention and wanted it publicized worldwide. He said he was fed up with Italy's spaghetti and mandolins reputation when it had brilliant doctors and scientists. "If I were Giorgio Armani, people would talk about my creation. You can call me the Armani of medicine," he joked. A colourful character who'd certainly make great radio, I thought, if I could just get my microphone in the same room with him. I emailed Armani House Pinelli one more time, the night before our rescheduled interview. "Looking forward to meeting you tomorrow and hope there won't be any problems this time." "There's never a second without a third," chuckled my partner when I told him I was due to go to Brescia again the following morning. "You Italians are so negative," I replied. "We English say third time lucky." We took bets on which national saying would come out tops. As with the football, Italy won. This time I was told he was sick. Pinning down Pinelli, it seems, is almost as hard as finding the Higgs boson. I'm convinced he exists, but I just can't see him.
Danny Mitzman with that postcard from a train station in northern Italy. And poor Danny was so exhausted after all that she's had to take a holiday. But we should mention that she's since been re-invited for a fourth bite of the cherry. So perhaps when she returns from the land of mad dogs, we may bring you more on the pioneering Dr. Roberto Pinelli. For now, though, that's all from Spectrum on DW. Don't forget, you can always keep up with our stuff at dw.de/science. Listen again or download the podcast at dw.de/spectrum. Tweet us all you like at DW_SciTech. I'm Zulfikar Abani. Our studio tape was Matt Greber. Until next time, take care, and of course, happy birthday to my son Max. It's his first. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.